மிஸ்டர் கேரி ஜேக்கப்ஸ் அவர்களும் மிஸ்டர் சந்திரசேகர் அவர்களும் மேட்டர் என்ற தலைப்பில் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். முதலாவதாக மிஸ்டர் கேரி ஜேக்கப்ஸ் அவர்கள் மேட்டர் என்ற தலைப்பில் பேசுவார். ஐ எம் இன்வைட்டிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி டு ஸ்டார்ட் தி ஸ்பீச்.
குட் மார்னிங். Today we are taking up chapter 24, the first of two chapters in Life Divine on matter. I'm sure Bindo makes it very easy for us because he starts the chapter by quoting from the Upanishads, the simple statement that matter is Brahman. All is Brahman, and matter too is Brahman. So we might be tempted to say we've already got the answer, we've solved the problem, solved the mystery, and we can go on to something else. But after hearing this, actually the whole mystery remains. What does it mean to say that matter is Brahman? Does it mean that the scientist is right and matter is all there is and everything is matter and there's nothing else than matter, and even our thoughts and our feelings are only electrical and chemical impulses? Or did the rishis mean something else? Does it mean that God also is just a physical substance like our bodies? Or does he mean something else? I think you recognize this. This is Pemberley.
I want to start with an experiment. Close your eyes. Imagine Pemberley as Elizabeth first saw it. Imagine that you're riding up the road in the carriage with her. Listen to the popping sound of the horse's feet on the ground. Listen to the, hear the waterfall under the bridge. The birds chirping in the trees. Feel the warmth of the bright sunshine as you come out from the shade. Smell the flowers that are blooming. Admire the sparkling beauty of the stream flowing beneath the bridge and the grandeur of this first sight of this magnificent palatial building. Now let's get down from the carriage and walk inside through the main doors, huge rosewood doors. Removing your sandals, walk with your feet on the rich crimson Persian carpet that cover the floor. Feel how soft they are. Hear the dim echo of the piano playing in the distance and some laughter. See the reflection of the candlelight in a thousand mirrors on the wall. Who is it that sees these things that you see in your imagination? Where do they exist? It is you who create those images in your imagination, those sensations in your imagination, and they exist only in your mental consciousness. All you imagine is what Jane Austen has created in her imagination. It's all real to her creative consciousness and to our imaginations as we read and contemplate her story. The world of Pemberley is an expression and an extension of Jane Austen's consciousness. In fact, it exists only in her and by her consciousness. And now, because we share it in our consciousness. Ember leaves the very stuff of her consciousness, which has formed the scene, this scene out of itself. She has become this scene while never ceasing to be Jane Austen, just as our minds imagine ourselves in this scene without ever ceasing to be who we are. When you reach out to touch the walls of Pemberley in your imagination, what are you touching? You're touching a form of your own consciousness, which presents itself to your imagination as an object. It's a mental substance. When we read the story, Darcy and Elizabeth are characters to us. They're characters that exist in Jane Austen's creative consciousness. She's created them. They exist within her. They are real to her. She can not only see them and listen to them, she can climb inside their mind and look out and know how it feels to be Elizabeth, know how it feels to be Darcy, know how it feels for Darcy to see Elizabeth, call her tolerable, know how it feels for Elizabeth to hear that. Yet all of this is taking place within her consciousness. And the consciousness of Elizabeth and the consciousness of Darcy and the consciousness of Jane Austen are all one. They are objects in her consciousness. In a similar fashion, he tells us that in this chapter, the divine has created the entire living physical universe by the same process that Jane Austen has created this world of Pemberley, Meryton, Longbourn, and Netherfield in her imagination. What is the difference? The only difference is that the world created by the divine is not only real to our imaginations, it's real to our physical senses and our sense mind. In fact, it was real before we were even around, and before human beings were around. It was real to somebody's consciousness. It was real and concrete as it is to us today, even before there were human beings. But she we should have all of Pemberley. He's touching a form of his own consciousness, presenting itself to him as an object of perception. The whole world is an object, Satchitananda, looking at himself and viewing himself as an object. In this case, a physical object of physical substance. The universe is created out of the consciousness of the divine being, out of the stuff of his consciousness, which is Satchitananda. The world is formed out of spiritual substance. It exists only in him and by him and has no reality outside of him. But because Brahman, Satchitananda, is fully real, the ultimate reality, the world he has conceived is fully real as well. Because a finite world is a frontal appearance of the infinite. We are seeing, when we look at the finite, when we look at the walls of Pemberley, when we look at the objects in our own house. We are looking at Brahman, but we're looking at the central appearance of Brahman, a form of Brahman that the infinite has taken and appears to its own vision as finite form. Thus, he says, the whole world, the whole material world is nothing but Satchidananda. Satchidananda is the ultimate playwright who can create the physical realities that he imagines. Jane Austen can only create them in thought. She can write them in story. And if she's lucky, as she is, they can be produced as movies. But what we see in the story or watch in the movie, Satchidananda becomes in the material world. This, in essence, is the knowledge that Sri Aurobindo gives us in this chapter. How the matter is Brahman. And he's going to explain to us step by step how that process takes place and how Satchidananda becomes the material world. He starts by telling us that matter plays an essential role in the manifestation of spirit, in the scheme of the spirit in the universe. Without matter, a life divine, a divine life on earth is simply not possible. And he explains why. He says that matter is the pedestal on which life stands. Without the material base, life would be an evanescent thing, without fixed solid form. It's the embodied soul lives in the material body so that it can have a lasting, a stable platform and identity. Without a physical body, we cannot speak or act in the material world. The body is our means of self-expression. It's also our means of physical experience, which is so important for the spiritual evolution. Life evolves out of matter, he says, as an enchasing seed. Life is a many-branching tree that sprouts out of matter. And we have learned, how can a living tree come out of something non-living? He's answered that mystery in the chapters on life, the four chapters on life, by telling us, because life is there within matter. And matter is nothing but the force of life concealed in a form. And as life is concealed in the form of matter, like a seed. Mind is concealed in that form. Supermind is concealed in that form. But in fact, that form is really a form of Satchidananda, of Brahman. Matter is the essential foundation for the divine life. The evolution of the spirit depends on this physical principle, and that's why Mother says, human beings are the only beings that can evolve spiritually. God cannot evolve unless they come down to earth and take the form of the human body. Human beings, our human body is very important and very special. Human beings have developed mentality because we have brains that are capable of conscious mental thought, of mental activity that other animals are not capable of. Man descends from Manu, the progenitor of all human beings. We walk upright, unlike most animals. We have hands that are capable of very intricate, dexterous movements. We have brains capable of conscious mental activity. A divine life requires a body that not only has a lot of capacities like this, but something more. It requires a body that can live indefinitely, that can be immortal if the soul chooses. Otherwise, it cannot be divine life. As long as we are subjected to diseases or incapacities or limitations of any type. Because by divine life, we really mean we become divine, we become infinite. For that, the human body, however great and advanced it may be, is not enough. Unless our body too can evolve, unless our material substance can evolve, a divine, perfect manhood, a divine life is simply not possible. And therefore, it's not enough that our soul evolves, our mind evolves, our life evolves. Matter too must be capable of an evolution, of an awakening. How can it be capable of an awakening? How can it be capable of evolving if it's nothing but dumb, inconscient, material substance? He says it's capable of that evolution because this material substance is only the form, only the appearance. Sleeping within it is the spirit, is the conscious being. And the whole evolution is to awaken the conscious being hidden within us, as it's to awaken our soul in man, it's to awaken the conscious being in matter. But in the tradition tells us that the body is the soul's greatest difficulty. The body is looked down on and condemned by almost all religious traditions because it's gross. It introduces so many problems for the soul that wants to soar high. The body believes only what it sees and feels. How can it believe in spirit? How can it know something that its eyes cannot perceive, its hands cannot touch? I'm sure we've all had the experience after the highest, most wonderful spiritual experience. After the glow wears off, we wake up the next morning and we feel quite ordinary. Maybe we have a pain in the leg or an ache in the head or any of the normal things. As if the body has not noticed the glorious, wonderful feeling we had during the meditation. The body is subject to material limitations that prevent it from expressing the spirit. And unless those limitations are overcome, there can be no divine life. So the religious traditions, the spiritual traditions have been asked to get rid of the body, cut it away from it, seek liberation or moksha as the solution to the problem. Sri Aurobindo says if you go back to the older traditions, like in the Veda, they knew that earth is the mother, heaven the father are both divine and both necessary for our fulfillment. And they revered the material principle as much as they did the spiritual principle. The problem of matter can be reduced to three characteristics that it has. In the next chapter, which we'll discuss next month, he calls it the knot of matter. Matter is inconscient. Our mortal bodies, our bodies are unconscious. They're ignorant. Even when we think of mother, the body remains what it was. There also, the body is very susceptible to suggestion. If somebody comes and sees you and says, oh, you look very pale and tired, you should be careful for your health, are you sure you're feeling all right? Half the time we'll begin to feel tired. We'll begin to wonder what's wrong with us. Yes, I better rest today, I've been working too hard. It's subject to suggestion. The body responds to vibrations like a child. I had the experience 25 years ago. My friend was traveling with a scientist. That scientist had a severe back, older man had a severe back pain. And before my friend finished the trip, he was having a severe back pain, as if back pain is contagious. He came back to Pondicherry and told me about the suffering he had, and I laughed, how can you get back pain from somebody else? And 1 week later, we were on a trip, a business trip to Uti, and suddenly I got severe back pain. And it lasted for a long time. The body is so childish, so susceptible, that it can believe things and make them true, because it's inconscient. The body is also subject to inertia, the material. Inertia means things don't move, they don't like to change. Our body is a creature of habit. It's very difficult to learn, teach it something, and once it's learned something, it's impossible to make it forget. We grow up eating particular type of food when we're young, and for the rest of our life, we feel this is the only food that our body can eat. We get used to a particular climate, a particular way of sitting, particular clothes, and it must have this. Life is constantly struggling to give up this inertia, because life wants change. Life wants to constantly experience things that are different. The body always says, no, let's keep it the way it is. Life wants to master the world. The body keeps saying, my capacities are limited. The spirit is constant change. The spirit evolves at lightning speed. Our soul seeks to be always fresh, always discovering something new. But the body says, no, I'm comfortable. This is my favorite chair. This is my favorite place. This is the time of day when I should be taking a nap, and so forth. It's a creature of habit. And it's very difficult for us to escape the gravitational pull, the heavy downward pull of the inertia of the body. Mother tells the story of a servant in the ashram, a young woman who she raised from an early childhood, and arranged, she sent that woman to France, where she got a French education, and became a member of the French society. And when she was 25 or 30, she came back to Pondicherry. Mother took her back in, and she started stealing. And mother called her, and the girl said, yes, I'm not able to overcome the habits of my childhood. Even though you have given me so much and shown me the world, my old habits are still there. And the third characteristic of matter is atomic disaggregation, atomic division. Matter is an infinite, is divided into an infinite number of small, tiny particles, objects, molecules, atoms, subatomic particles, infinitely numerous. But the spirit, we understand, is one. It's unified. Everything's connected. Yet we live in a body that says, I'm separate from everybody else. I have to take care of myself. I have to look out for me. If I don't feed myself, who will? I have to take care of my sleep. The body feels separate from everybody else, which is the grand denial of the spiritual truth of our oneness. Our problems are more than that. Not only are there problems of matter itself, but we have problems because our mind and our life and our body are at constant war with one another. They're in constant conflict with one another. They're constantly quarreling with one another. Your life wants to go on and do so many things, and always it's faced with the principle of death. You may try anything, but you can't live forever. Ultimately, I'm going to win. That's what death tells Savitri. Charlotte's quite conscious of the fact that matter is going to win. And so she says, I can't be thinking about love and romance and happiness and all those things. I have to look out for myself. I need material security. So I'll marry Colin. He gives me a small parlor and some chickens, and I'll be happy. That's the way life surrenders to matter. Our minds are all the time quarreling with our life and matter. Mind doesn't like any limitations. It likes to soar. It likes to change. Mind is like Mr. Bennett. He doesn't like all the problems of life and responsibility. He doesn't want to hear about the burden of marrying five girls. He wants to go and be in the library where he can contemplate by himself. Mind revolts against the passions and sufferings of life, like Mary Bennett. She preaches a very proper abstinence and moderation. No dancing for her. She believes in better things. The mind and the vital want freedom from physical constraints. Wickham, Collins reject their sense of class inferiority because of their birth. They want to rise up. She said, we don't want to be limited by our birth. Eliza says she wants to marry for love, not for money or security. Lydia wants freedom from everything, freedom from society. She wants the freedom to follow any red coat that she wants. Mind appears to conquer life and body, to dominate them, to control our cravings, to subject us to its moral laws and understanding. But it's only a temporary victory mind has. Ultimately, the life prevails and the body prevails, and when the body's tired, it sleeps and it doesn't consult anybody about its needs. And the spiritual man, he condemns all the three of them as useless, as instruments of the devil. He blames mind for its confusion. He blames life for its desires. He blames body for its dullness, its grossness. He says, let's reject all of them and have severance. Let's sever ourselves from the body, mind, and of moksha. So how do we resolve this battle between these our principles, matter, life, mind, and spirit? He tells us ultimately there's no escape. from this problem unless we can solve the mystery of matter, unless matter is capable of transformation. And he says, he's going to tell us why the divine has created the material universe. He's going to tell us how it evolves. He says that ultimately this victory, we need a victory of the spirit in matter. This can become the universe. Such it and under the beginning, the middle, and the end, all the struggle is only temporary. It's part of the game, it's part of the play, it's part of the evolutionary experience. Everything is laboring towards a perfect solution and a complete victory. He calls it a perfect victory of the spirit. What would be a perfect victory of the spirit? It would be to have free and perfect use of the body in life. A body which does anything we want, which can live forever, which has the strength and capacity and endurance to do whatever we may want it to do. A life that lends itself to mind's highest aspirations and highest ideals and doesn't become selfish or greedy or impatient or filled with cravings and lust and passion or falsehood or any of these other things. And the spirit, our spirit, needs a free and perfect mastery over mind, life, and body as its instrument so that it can express itself divinely in the world. And this is the victory towards which the world is moving. This is the divine intention. All this depends on what is the reality of matter. This possibility of a victory is only possible if matter has that potential to offer this type of cooperation. And he tells us that our present knowledge of light, of matter, and our experience of matter is not the truth of matter. It's merely a phenomenal appearance. It's a particular relationship that our consciousness has with material substance. It's the way we look at matter, experience matter, that gives it the characteristics that it has today. He said matter is a phenomenal appearance. This is a diagram of an atom with a nucleus in the middle and electrons outside. We cannot see atoms. They're so small. We can see only aggregations of millions and billions of atoms that look to us like a piece of stone or a coin or a diamond or something like that. But if you could shrink down to be the size of an electron or a proton, and if you could stand at the center of that atom in the nucleus and look out, you would see that each tiny little atom is like a huge football stadium with tiny little birds flying around in the air at great distance at the top of the stadium, and everything in between is open space. It's a big empty stadium, each little atom. But we don't see it that way because we look at it through our physical senses. When we look at the earth, we see the soil under our feet. We see the horizon. If we go to the beach, we can see the sunrise and sunset. But that's not the only way we can know the earth. If we look from another perspective, we would see the earth like this, as a huge sphere. We don't see it that way. And one among millions or billions of spheres, some illumined, some not, some reflecting, some shining in outer space. When we look up at the sky, we see so many stars. They're the stars in our galaxy, which is known as the Milky Way. But if we looked at the Milky Way from a very, very long distance, we would see something more like this. A huge whirling light in the sky, which is composed of millions and millions of stars twinkling. We look at a flower. The flower looks very different to the ant that's crawling on the leaf, or the bird that's flying overhead. We see the sunshine. The flowers also sense the sun, but not through eyes the way we do. When Darcy sees Elizabeth for the first time, he looks at her with his senses and says, she's tolerable. Later he looks again with his awakened emotion and he sees a light in her eyes. And later he sees only the wonder of his life, the soulmate. He sees the most beautiful, magnificent thing imaginable, because he sees not with the physical senses, but sees with the soul, with the vision of his soul. So what we see depends on the faculty we use in order to see it. Science tells us that matter is a form of energy. Matter is not a solid thing at all. There is no such thing as a solid thing. It's only tiny little balls of energy floating around, and each of those balls is consisting of smaller balls of energy. There's nothing but energy circling around and giving the appearance of a form, a solid form. And he told us earlier that all forms are forms of force. The whole idea, the very idea of a form, as if there's something that just is. All forms are consist of energy, consist of force. Atoms consist of balls of energy circling around the center. We see a solid object really and then Shrivindo tells us it's a greater truth. Science has discovered the truth that matter is a form of force. And he says the rishis discovered a greater truth, and that is that matter exists only as a substantial appearance of consciousness. Matter is only the form which consciousness takes. Takes to who? Whose consciousness takes to who? Who is viewing that form and whose consciousness consists of that form? And he tells us, that form is a form of Satchitananda's consciousness. And that which is viewing the form is Satchitananda viewing himself as an object, the way we look at ourselves in a mirror. All things are forms of one substance, which is spiritual substance. The substance which we call spirit or Satchitananda. Well, we haven't really answered any question. We're back to where we started from, that matter is Brahman, and do we understand anything more? The real question is, why does matter appear the way it does? And if matter is really Brahman, why doesn't it show us what it is? Why don't we see Satchitananda instead of seeing marble and granite and wood and so many other things? Matter is the appearance that Bhaktivedanta undertakes to our senses. Because what we call matter is created by sense. When our mind contacts an object through its senses, we sense it as material form. When we view an object through our eyes or with any of the five senses, it is our senses that tell us this is something solid. This is something stable. This is something immobile. It's our mind that uses the senses as an instrument to see something as an object, which it feels separate from itself. So Darcy wants to know, who is this Elizabeth Bennet, who's the sister of James? How can he know her? Bingley points her out, he turns in her direction, he looks at her with his eyes. Through his senses, he sees a form, and he thinks he sees Elizabeth and knows Elizabeth. Actually, he only sees the data which his senses tell him. And our physical senses are a very limited, obscure, external way of knowing things. When he sees Elizabeth's form, he doesn't know how lively Elizabeth is. He doesn't know how strong she is. He doesn't know how courageous she is. He simply sees the outside. We not only have physical senses, we have vital sense and mental sense as well. When Wickham tells Elizabeth that he's very happy to be in Meryton because he's keeping company with her, and she's such a lovely young woman, she sees Wickham's a very, very handsome, nice man. Why? Because she's experiencing Wickham through her vital sensation, which we call attitude. She likes him. So she knows Wickham not for what he is. He's a total scoundrel. He's a rogue. He's a liar. She knows him through the vital sensation, which is very pleasing because he's flattering her. When Mrs. Bennet hears that a rich man has occupied Netherfield, it's only an idea. But to her idea, it stimulates her mental sensation. And she thinks, aha, a rich man who's not married, that means a husband for one of my daughters. And her mind gets activated by that. That fact of a man occupying Netherfield is seen by her sense, her mental sense, as a great opportunity for her. Our eyes don't see that opportunity. Her mind sees that opportunity because it uses the faculty of mental sensation. The thing that all these senses have in common is they look at things from the outside. The famous proverb we all know, you cannot know a book by its cover. From the outside of the book, you cannot know the story of Pride and Prejudice. You cannot know how alive characters are, how humorous, how dramatic, how vibrant the story is with life and knowledge. Our senses cannot tell us the story. Our senses cannot tell us the characters. Our senses cannot tell us the joy that Darcy feels of the romance or the knowledge that we gain from this story. The famous analogy used in the Upanishads, maybe even the Veda, I'm not sure. A man sees something on the road, he cannot, unmoving, he cannot tell whether it's a rope or a snake. There's a big difference between a rope and a snake, but the snake is sleeping. To the senses, they may look from a distance almost identical. So our senses see things only from the outside in. So it's not surprising matter is really Satchidananda, that we are not going to discover that with our eyes or our nose or our ears or even our sense of touch, because we are only touching the outer form, not the inner essence of what matter is. Our senses can't tell us what another person is thinking or feeling. We say appearances are deceiving. Elizabeth keeps staring at her at the hands. She seems he's staring at her out of disapproval, or maybe even mockery. Maybe he's laughing at her. In fact, he's passionately falling in love with her. Her senses cannot tell her that. Our senses convert the data that comes to us through them into forms that we perceive. So we all see when we look at this painting, the famous painting we all know, it's small. But what are we actually seeing? In the upper right-hand corner, we've taken a blow-up of her eye. Actually, what you see in that photo are only tiny little block squares of color. But when we look at it from a distance, we see those squares. No, it's her eye. She's alive, a bright, shiny eye. There is no eye. This photo is only tiny little pixel squares of color, different shades of color mixed together. We don't see that. We see, oh no, the eye is there. It's all perfect. There's nothing missing. That's the sense mind interpreting the data of our vision to interpret it and see something. That's how when Elizabeth sees Wickham and sees he's so handsome, she says he must be a good man. What she sees is that he's handsome, but what her mind tells her is that she's good. This is how our thought mind is constantly interpreting the data of the senses. So since we see matter only externally, it doesn't move to us. We don't see the energy. We don't see the molecules moving. We don't see the atoms whirling. We don't see what's behind that. We don't see that life is concealed in that material object. We don't see that mind is sleeping in that object like the rope is really a snake. We don't see the Brahman, the spirit that has become that object. We only see it from the outside. We see the red coat, like Lizzie, and think we know the man. We think we know the man by his most external appearance. We think we know matter by its most external appearance, like judging people by their clothes. Can you tell by the clothes that a person wears whether they're good or bad? Whether they're telling the truth or lying? Whether they'll be loyal or disloyal? Whether they're happy or not, even though you can't tell just from the clothes. What do you see here? What do you see here? Many people say this is a butterfly. That's the most common response. Actually, this is an ink blot. Some of you may have made them in school when you were young. They simply take a piece of paper, drop a few drops of ink on it, fold the paper in half, and unfold it. But when we see this, for many of us, the mind says, no, this is an ink blot. Or maybe somebody says it's a bat. Or, I don't know what, or something else. But it's a nice design. Maybe it's a flower. All that's our interpretation. That's what the thought mind and the sense mind do, to interpret the data. Obviously, we won't know matter as long as we judge it by the senses. But this is the way we see matter. This is why matter looks to us the way it looks, because we look at it through the senses. What looks at it through the senses? It's not our soul that's looking at this through the senses. It's our mind. And we've already studied about mind, and we already know that mind has characteristics of its own. Mind divides everything. Mind divides reality infinitely. If you remember back to the chapters on supermind, he told us. In supermind, everything is one spiritual substance. Everything's connected. Everything is a form of the same reality of the divine. But somehow we end up in a world where everything looks to be separate from everything else. Each of us is separate from each other. We divide reality. We have friends. We have relatives. We have business associates, co-workers, employees, neighbors, enemies, creditors maybe. We have all different types of categories for our oneness, even though we're all one. This is what mind does. It divides everything. It divides reality and sees it as separate parts. What do you see here? What do you recognize here? Of course, this is Gandhiji, Buddha. But what is it really when mind analyzes it up closely? When mind analyzes it up closely, it turns out these are only letters and characters. I see a Z and an H and an E and an and sign and a hyphen and dash and colon and all. But our mind then aggregates and there's no difference. I see Gandhiji there very clearly. There's his nose, his eyes, his ears. So our mind divides an infinite unity into a countless number of parts. And then it aggregates and combines those parts to give a whole. And we say it's Gandhiji. So what we know as matter is the result of the fact that we're looking at it using the faculty of mind which divides and the faculty of sense which only looks at it from the outside in, only sees the surface. But what do we know? We know there are a number of characters. We know there are a number of events. We have divided life up into an infinite number of characters, places, and events. And then mind combines them together and creates a story out of it. What is a story? A story is simply one scene after another, we link them together in particular relation. Oh, these girls are all sisters to one another. These are the officers. Oh, these are the friends. This is Meryton, London, Netherfield, Rosings, Pemberley. He pieces all this together to make a whole. This is how mind creates its view of reality. So, mind has divided everything, and sense tries to piece it all together and present it to us as an object. And he says, so how is matter created? Do you mean that we are creating matter with our own minds? He says, no, it's not the individual mind of human beings that created matter. The universe existed long before. It is a mind that creates matter. Whose mind? It's the mind of Satchidananda. You've already heard that Satchidananda has a mind. As we know, Satchidananda puts forth supermind. Supermind is the mind that creates, the mind of Satchidananda that imagines or doesn't imagine, it creates all the forms that it wants to manifest in the universe. And that supermind has a subordinate power, which is mind, which is universal mind. Supermind's not in one place or one. Supermind is infinite. And the mind of supermind is a universal mind that's everywhere. And it is that power of the supermind to divide the reality that it has created into millions and billions of individual parts. And that mind, that universal mind, has a sense, a universal sense. And that universal sense views each of those forms from the outside as an object. Which object? Object of itself. They're all Satchitananda. So by analogy we could say, Satchitananda wants to see itself. It wants to experience itself. It's tired of being alone. It creates forms out of itself and it views itself. What's the idea of always seeing itself as Satchitananda? It wants to look at itself in different forms. It wants to see variety. So it puts on a set of sunglasses which divide its unity into many, many different parts and pieces, and it looks at those pieces as if they're separate things through its sunglasses, which it calls cosmic mind. And through the shading on those sunglasses, which is the senses, it sees the external appearance of all the objects it has become, because it has become all those objects. So the universe we experience is nothing but forms that Satchitananda has taken to become objects to its own experience. It's looking at itself. Is that hard to believe, or hard to conceive, or hard to imagine? This is exactly what Jane Austen has done when she created her story. Nothing different. She's sitting alone in her parlor or in her room and wants to write. She wants to amuse herself. She closes her eyes and imagines a story. She imagines Elizabeth Bennet, Darcy, Jane. She loves her sister in real life, so she imagines a sister that Elizabeth loves. Where do they exist? They're only forms in her mental consciousness. And she imagines all the scenes that are there in the story, lives them in her imagination, one by one by one, over and over and over again, and she enjoys them. But she's not content with that. It's not enough that she knows what Wickham looks like and Darcy looks like and Jane looks like and what happened. She wants to know when Darcy proposes to Elizabeth, she wants to know what it looks like from Elizabeth's point of view and what Elizabeth feels when Darcy talks to her about the embarrassment of her family. She's not content with that. She wants to also know what Darcy feels when she says, "You're the last man on earth that I would ever marry." So she takes the form of each of her characters individually, looks out on them, also through the same faculty of sense. She doesn't see inside of Darcy's mind. When Elizabeth looks at Darcy, she sees the outside of him, because she looks through her sense. Of course, it's not a physical sense, because Elizabeth doesn't exist. It's a sense in Jane Austen's creative imagination to look at her own consciousness as a form. Because Darcy's only a form of Jane Austen's consciousness. And who is looking at Jane Austen's consciousness? It's Elizabeth Bennet. Who is Elizabeth Bennet? She's also a form of Jane Austen's consciousness. How can one form look at another? Because Jane Austen is there inside of each of those forms. Jane Austen is there looking out from each of those forms, from all of those forms, from all of those forms simultaneously. So when the Bennet sisters meet with Wickham and Denny in Meryton for the first time, and Wickham and Bingley and Darcy drive by on the horses, she looks out from from their viewpoints, through their mind and through their sense. And she creates a world for herself. She creates a living world of forms that are real to her creative imagination. And what Jane Austen does in her mind, and then she writes it down as a story, Satchitananda does in its mind. Only Jane Austen's mind is confined to what's inside her head, and Satchitananda's mind is the universe. It's as grand as the universe, and it transcends the universe. And everything that's in the universe is a form in the mind of Satchitananda. We say in the mind of supermind. It takes place. The universe is in supermind. The supermind knows those forms are forms of Satchitananda. It wants the experience that Jane Austen wants. So what's the fun for Jane Austen if she knows they're all characters in her story? She wants to feel the reality of it. She wants to make it as real as possible. So instead of looking at the story as the author, she looks at the story the way Elizabeth looks at it. When Elizabeth gets word that Lydia is going to elope, Elizabeth doesn't tell herself, well, anyway, it's only a story, and I know I'm going to marry Darcy later. There's no life in that. There's no intensity in that. To know the ending before the beginning. She looks at it from Elizabeth Bennet's point of view. Who looks at it? Jane Austen, the author, who's writing the whole thing, who's becoming the whole thing. And that's the way Satchitananda becomes the universe and the forms in the universe and lives in each of those forms just the way Jane Austen lives in each of her characters. And looked out from each of those forms at every other form, just the way Elizabeth and Darcy and Wickham look out, or Jane, look out at one another. So, what we call matter is the creation of a universal mind, or he said a cosmic mind, that divides the unity, the spiritual unity of spiritual substance, by atomic division until it looks like an infinite number of independent objects. And then it relates to those objects through the faculty of sense. As if that object were separate from it, it contacts that object just the way Darcy comes into the room and looks at Lizzie, or Lizzie sees him staring, or Darcy looks at her and sees she's tolerable. It's all happening in Jane Austen's mind, but her faculty of sense puts all of that behind, and Darcy simply looks at the appearance and says she's tolerable. He doesn't recognize it's his soulmate. This is how Jane Austen creates her story. This is how you would create a story, or do if you write. And this is how cosmic mind creates the world. But there's another step. Jane Austen not only creates characters, she fills each of those characters with life. She takes the standpoint of each of those characters, not only the viewpoint of each of those characters, and she energizes it. And we have only to remember the scene when Lady Catherine comes to Longbourn to see how energetic the characters are, each from their own viewpoint. Is Pumberly to be polluted by my nephew marrying you? I'm a gentleman's daughter. I have nothing to be ashamed of. I'm everywhere his equal. We feel the passion. We feel the energy of Lady Catherine and Elizabeth as they war with one another and fight for supremacy, because Jane Austen has not just created separate forms or separate viewpoints, she's energized each of those viewpoints with vital energy, with the vitality to really believe, I am Elizabeth Bennet, I am Lady Catherine. And that's what cosmic mind does. It energizes each of the forms that it creates. with the energy, with the will of consciousness. Consciousness and force. So the consciousness creates the form, force energizes the form. And that's what we call life. He says it's a cosmic life. Then Elizabeth and Darcy look at one another. They're now not only seeing the forms of one another, they're feeling the intensity of love for one another, because each has become alive with energy and force. And that's what Satchidananda does. Through life, through the universal principle of life, it energizes every form it creates and gives it life. It may be the life of a flower or the life of an animal, the human life. In each case, the energy identifies with the form. It's a separate existence. Now we know, happen to know for a fact, that Elizabeth Bennet and Darcy don't exist as a separate existence. They only exist in the mind of Jane Austen, and now in our minds, because they become very real to our imagination as well. And in that sense, none of us exist as separate existences, separate from the consciousness of Satchidananda. We exist in such consciousness. We may think we're separate, but he knows we're not. We're all forms of him. We're all his creation and expression. And we're all evolving back to discover that we are one with all the other forms that we're interacting with, as Darcy discovers that he really wants to be one with Elizabeth. He loves her so much. And ultimately, we are one with Satchidananda, because that's what we really are. So, what have we learned? Spirit has become the universe. As Jane Austen can look at all the scenes and all the characters, they're all objects of her consciousness. Satchidananda looks at all that's created in the universe as objects of its consciousness. But it's not content with that any more than Jane Austen is. Satchidananda looks out from within each of these objects at all the other objects and sees them all as if they're separate, though they're only all forms of itself. Now when the Rishi, when the supramental being looks out from one of these forms, it sees all souls are its soul, are one with it. It sees matter as spiritual substance, which is what it really is. When we look out, we're like Darcy and Elizabeth, we're pretty blind. We see only the external appearances and what our mental sense and our vital sense can pick up when we look at each other. But when we look at a flower, we don't see the mind in the flower. We don't see the emotions in the flower. We only see the appearance. And when we look at a stone or a gem, we don't see life in the stone or the gem. We don't see mind in the stone or the gem. We certainly don't see Brahman, the soul, Satchidananda in the gem, because we're looking at it as if it's an external object. And we presume that that stone doesn't see us at all, because it doesn't have any eyes, it doesn't have any sense. But deep within that stone, there is a life waiting to emerge, a mind sleeping, and a hidden secret consciousness, the consciousness of Satchidananda. So, spirit has become the universe. He's been telling us, this is a summary of several chapters. Mind is the final action of supermind in its creation. Mind divides, performs, supermind creates. Life is the final action of the conscious force, of chit, working in the conditions of created by mind, working within the division, so that each object thinks it's a separate life, when in fact there's only one infinite universal life. And matter is the final form that conscious being takes in its working, when it's the final form, life is the force, that is how it appears to itself when Satchidananda views itself through universal mind and universal life. We can ask the question, why matter? Why go to all of this trouble? Why go bury yourself in matter just to awaken later on? And he says, this division is essential for the divine's purpose in the universe. The divine wants an infinite manifestation, an infinite delight, which can only come from an infinite experience. And the only way to have an infinite experience is to have an infinite number of beings experiencing each other in an infinitely complex multiplicity of ways. And if you want an infinite number of beings each experiencing things differently, then you need each being to think and feel as if it's different and separate from all the others. If every thought you have is in my head, and every feeling I have is in your head, or every time I eat something, you taste it, then we'll all be tasting the same thing all the time. There'll be no variety there. Divine wants infinite experience, infinite variety. So matter is the invention, is the creation that the divine has fashioned to enable it to manifest multiplicity of being, instead of just oneness of being, which it is, through an infinite number of separate centers of consciousness, each expressing, each experiencing differently. Imagine trying to write Pride and Prejudice if there's only one character. Jane Austen's the only character. How can you have a love story? How can you have the drama? How can you have the joy? There'll be nobody even to share the jokes. How can you manifest love without a lover and a beloved? We know that the separation and conflict between Darcy and Elizabeth is the key to their ecstatic delight at the end of the book. Lydia's elopement becomes a very important event because finally we can feel the delight that she saved and everything is not lost. This all requires multiplicity of different centers of consciousness. Mind is the result of that will for multiplicity in separate centers of consciousness. And through cosmic sense and cosmic life, it makes that multiplicity not just separate forms or centers of consciousness, separate centers of life, separate physical appearing as physical objects. But we also know that in reality, this sense of separateness is a fiction. Even for us human beings, no person can live for themselves as a famous. No man is an island. When we are all to ourselves, we lose our humanity. None of us can live without the environment we live in, without the air and the food, the water. None of us can really live full lives as human beings without society, without people to interact with, to share with, to learn from, to teach, to give to receive from. Otherwise, we are animals. None of us can live only for ourselves. Films in living for others, in being responsible for others, in giving joy to others. It's the ego that gives us the sense of being separate, the illusion of being separate, though in fact we never are. And to become a real individual is not to be aware of our separateness, but to be aware of our connection and oneness with everyone else. So finally, in summary, what has he told us? He's told us that Satchidananda has conceived of itself as object to its own consciousness. Satchidananda conceives, what does it conceive? It conceives objects. What are those objects? Itself, because there's nothing else. It can't create anything other than itself. And who perceives those objects? It perceives them. They become the objects to its own consciousness. Just like Jane Austen creating her characters and then admiring them. Oh, I like, Lizzie's my favorite character. Satchidananda extends itself into its objects that it creates, and it experiences itself and all its other objects from within each of those objects. When it experiences itself as an object, it experiences itself as substance, as something, as a form, not merely as pure spirit. It feels itself as pure spirit. If I close my eyes and try to feel myself, I know I'm here, I'm self-aware. But when I look in the mirror, or when I touch myself, I'm experiencing myself as an object. It's still me. But instead of subjectively experiencing myself, by self-awareness, I'm objectively experiencing myself as an object of knowledge. And that's what Satchidananda does. And the universe is Satchidananda, the object that Satchidananda has created of itself so that it can experience itself as forms. It uses its faculty of cosmic mind and cosmic life to divide this substance infinitely to give it the appearance of separate objects. And it looks out at those objects through its faculty of sense, looks at them externally through universal sense to see them just on the surface. And so they appear to it as material substance. That's what we call material substance. And what Satchidananda does, we also do. We also look out on the world through our minds and our senses and experience it as material substance. But mind, life, matter are really Brahman. They're the being. They're the being in its creative action, in its expressive action, when it wants to become something, when it wants to take a form. So he says the reality is that matter is consciousness which holds it concealed within it, the self-secret. Elizabeth is really Jane Austen. But she hides herself within Elizabeth, and we only see a little on the surface, which we call Elizabeth, or Darcy, or Jane, or Mrs. Bennet. All really have the whole of Jane Austen's secret within them. Every form in the universe has Satchidananda's secret within it. That consciousness is involved, absorbed, self-absorbed, the way we are when we sleep. So he summarizes, matter is Satchidananda. Matter is the being, Sat, manifesting itself as form. It's the consciousness of being, expressing itself as force. And that force cast into a form. And it is the delight of Satchidananda hidden within each form that's trying to awaken the hidden consciousness within the form. So Darcy, when he sees Elizabeth, and the more he gets to know Elizabeth, the contact, the external contact with Elizabeth, first through the senses, then through the mind, the mental exchanges, then through the emotions, are gradually awakening him. What are they awakening him to? They're awakening him to be conscious of his own soul. The material contact with Elizabeth is helping Darcy to discover his own soul. And the love he feels is the love of his soul. It's the love of love. And that is the role of matter in the universe. Matter is the object that Satchidananda presents to that hidden consciousness to help awaken it to the delight of existence. So it will awaken in the form and know itself as the divine being. I'll stop here. There's about 5 minutes before the 12. If there's any questions. When you get this, it's very simple, but at first it's a complete inversion of way of thinking about things. Well, if there are no questions, what is the implication of this for us? The implication is, as Baba has been telling us, Mother tells us, every material object has the secret consciousness hidden within it. And that's why material objects respond to attention. That's why if you consecrate or offer affection to a lost object, it comes back, that so many devotees have had that experience. That's why even the body, although it tends to believe anybody says anything's wrong with it, that's why the body has the capacity to cure itself. And even in the case of Morris Goodman, when he was 4 or 5 days from death, he's able to reconstruct itself because there is secret consciousness in the body, in every cell of the body, and that can respond to our prayers, that can respond to our faith, and it can cure itself of anything because the divine is there within that body. And the practical implication of this is if we want to reveal that all the material world is only a frontal appearance for the infinite. The divine is there in everything. Infinite potential is there in everything. And one of the ways we bring out that potential is by striving for perfection in anything you do. I'm sure the perfection of cleanliness has a tremendous power. Why? Because it releases what's hidden behind the form. I'm sure many of you remember the story of the perfectly written letter written to the big multinational company, and it created a big opportunity because there was no single error in the letter. As always said, if you can have a perfect book without a single grammatical or typographical error, that book will sell tremendously because of the physical perfection. So anything we do, if we do it perfectly, it releases something of the spirit that's hidden in the form.